In this episode, it's a children's BBC special, as I talk to TV and radio presenter Simon Parkin about his time in the broom cupboard. Then, I talk to Guy Lambert, former TV producer, about working for the BBC in the 2000s. That's all to come on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast, a podcast about UK pop culture of the 90s and 2000s. And if you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email 90sandnoughties@gmail.com. You can tweet us at 90sandnoughtiesUK on Twitter, or you can just go to the Facebook page, which is 90sandnoughtiesUK. So, it's a children's BBC special, and later I talk to former TV producer Guy Lambert about what it was like to work at CBBC between 2003 and 2010. But first, this. I talk to Simon Parkin of Broom Cupboard fame about working at the BBC in that time and everything that he's done since then as well. Thank you for joining us today, Simon. Many people will remember you from your days at CBBC in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. How did that journey begin for you?
I was just very lucky, more than anything else. I grew up desperate to be Noel Edmonds. He was my hero. He was my role model. He was doing Radio 1, The Breakfast Show, and he was doing Swap Shop on the telly. And I thought, gosh, I would love to do that job. And so I saw radio as being the way in. And so I did hospital radio when I was still at school, and I did like mobile DJing and that kind of stuff. And there weren't so many radio stations back then as there are now. And I was sending off little tapes of my hospital radio shows to every radio station, all of the BBC ones, all of the commercial ones. And eventually I got a job on a station called Radio Tees, which was, there's now a BBC Radio Tees, just to make it a bit more confusing. But back then it was a commercial station in Teesside serving Middlesbrough and Stockton-on-Tees and a bit of North Yorkshire. And I went up there at the age of 20 to do the evening show. It was on between 6 and 8, and it was sort of a young poppy show. There wasn't the telly output that there is now, and so it was very popular with young people. And so we had like the homework, people would be, you know, because they didn't want to watch Coronation Street on the telly, the young people would be listening to the radio where we'd be playing the pop songs. And while I was there, Philip Schofield had been doing children's BBC from the broom cupboard, and he was going to be moving to the Saturday morning show, which at that point it was still Mike Reed's Saturday Superstore. When Philip Schofield was going to take it over, it was going to be going live. But we didn't know any of that at this point. It just was in the paper. Philip Schofield, the boy from the afternoons, is moving onto the Saturday morning show. And so there was a guy at my radio station. I used to do a programme that was on a Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. The bloke who was on between 6 and 9 in the morning, the breakfast show man, desperate to be on the telly. And I said, oh, I've seen this thing in the paper. You should go for it. And he said, oh, no, I'm too tall. They won't want me. And he was like really proper miserable. And so I then said to the guy who came on after me, oh, you know, I was saying to Mark, he should go for this job at the children's BBC. And the guy who's on after me, a fella called Andy Hollins, who now works in Hollywood, said to me, he said, well, no, you should go for it. And I said, yeah, but I've only been at Radio Tees for like 2 months. I've got a long way ahead of me. I don't want to go off and be on the telly. And he said, no, look, I auditioned for children's BBC when Andy Crane auditioned, and Andy Crane got the job and I didn't, says Andy Hollins. So look, here's the name of the man to phone. And he wrote on a piece of paper, Pat Hubbard, and a telephone number. And I sat and looked at this telephone and I thought, I can't do anything with this. So I then sort of stayed at work for a couple of days and then got into trouble for doing something and had a really bad day and was thinking, oh God. And I thought, right, I'm going to phone this man. So I phoned this BBC number. And I literally just dialed the number that Andy Hollins had scored on the piece of paper. And the man, Pat Hubbard, answered the phone. And I said, oh, hello, I read in the paper about Philip Schofield leaving the afternoons, and I'd love to do that job. No, he said. Well, that's absolutely not the case. That's not happening at all. We're not looking for anybody, but just tell me a little bit about yourself. So I said, well, I'm a local radio DJ. I've been working for a couple of months for this radio station. He said, well, when do you come to London? And I said, well, I don't really ever come to London. And he said, well, when is your next day off? And I said, well, Thursday. And he said, right, come to London on Thursday and come and meet me at Television Centre. So I put the phone down. OK. So I then, Thursday came, and I got on a train and went to London. 4-hour train journey from Stockton-on-Tees to down to London, and got off the train and got on the tube and went to, stood outside the iconic building that is Television Centre, and went to the reception and said, oh, I'm here to meet Pat Hubbard. Yep, come on in. It signed me through. And then this fella called Pat Hubbard comes downstairs, shakes hands with me and says, all right, come and have a look round. So he then showed me round Television Centre. Now, I'm just having the best day ever in the history of the world. And then he says, well, now, would you mind if I stuck you in a studio and see how you do? And I said, absolutely not. And so he sat me in a studio, put an earpiece in my ear, clipped a microphone onto me. And he said, right, I'm going to go into the gallery. You just sit here, look at this camera. And then through the earpiece, clicked over. Right, tell me a little bit about yourself. So I just chatted for a little while. And he then said, OK, that's fine. And then he came back into the studio and we unplugged the mic. And as we walked out, he said, I'm really sorry. That was awful of me. I should really have given you a bit of warning that I was going to audition you. But you were brilliant. Would you like to come and work here? And literally, from having, you know, 2 days ago phoned this man randomly, I was then told I had a job. And so I then came and did Children's BBC for the Christmas mornings for 2 weeks. And then I went back to the radio station again, and then came and did Children's BBC for the Easter holidays, and then came back again for the summer, and then just stayed for like 5 years. And it was just, I'm pretty sure had I not phoned at that exact moment, I would never have got that opportunity, because I'm pretty sure had I phoned like an hour later, he might have been busy, he might not have answered his phone. Had I phoned an hour earlier, he might not have had lunch yet and therefore might not have had some alcohol and might not have been a bit merry and thought, well, I'll just invite this guy down. And so that was it. So Children's BBC was just one of those, you know, the most amazing lucky break. And also what was even more lucky is that when I started on Children's BBC, I wasn't very good because I was young, I was inexperienced, I didn't know anything about telly. And thankfully, I was guided by the people who said, well, all right, well, look, we can help you with this and try this and do that and come back again. Whereas I could have just done the 2 weeks and been awful and never come back at all. And thankfully, they said, OK, come back and let's see if we can, you know, let's try something else and let's do this. And then it all sort of worked out. So that's how my Children's BBC job came about.
Like you say, extremely lucky. Many people of a certain age have great memories of CBBC during that period, especially in the broom cupboard. Was it really self-operated?
Yeah, it really genuinely was the little studio where the very deep voice of the BBC world. So we would share the space with the BBC One announcers who would be going, now on BBC One, here's Alan Titchmarsh with Pebble Mill at One. And but they would be behind a caption or behind the globe that used to go round. And so Pat Hubbard, a couple of years before I came and joined Children's BBC, knew that there was a better way of putting out the children's programmes than the BBC were doing. But he had no budget and he had no you know, team as such to speak of to get a programme together. So he said, right, well, if we bolt a camera onto the side of the monitor stack in the BBC Continuity Studio, which is like a little tiny radio studio where they had the faders that put up the sound and the pictures. And the monitor stack was all of the different TVs, so you can see all of the different sources. And they fixed a camera, and because it was bolted on, you didn't need a cameraman. And the camera then was just a button on the desk. And so instead of cutting up the BBC Globe or a slide saying, you know, what's on BBC Two at the minute, you could cut up a camera. And then they could do it with Philip Schofield, just one presenter, It would be working in the office, answering the mail, going through the post. They had a secretary called Doreen, who was there for pretty much all of Children's BBC's life, and one producer. And they then put it on air, and it just became this lovely, because it was quite simple, because it was quite straightforward, because, you know, you could send a letter in or a drawing and it would be on telly the day after tomorrow. It just became this very inclusive, nice club, and the ratings were phenomenal. And when I was there, we had, as Children's BBC finished, Neighbours started. So we would finish at 5:30 and then Neighbours would start. And Neighbours was getting something like 12 million viewers. So 12 million viewers would accidentally tune in for the last bit of Children's BBC because they wanted to watch Neighbours. And so we were getting, you know, no TV show on terrestrial television, on ITV or the BBC now, gets 12 million viewers, not even your X Factors, your Strictlys. You know, they get sort of 8 or 9 million and go, wow, this is great. We were accidentally getting 12. And it was just such a phenomenal success. And thankfully, because it was so, you know, it was simple and it was straightforward and it was, you know, it was just fun. Little 10 seconds of fun. People, like you say, have a very fond memory of it, which is, you know, really lovely. And so many people that still come up to me go, oh, gosh, Children's BBC. It's nice. It's never, oh, we used to hate that. Because it just, you know, what was there to hate? It was just this lovely little kind of, you know, funny little broom cupboard.
You also did But First This, which was like the summer replacement and Christmas and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, we used to. Children's BBC was originally just the afternoons, and then they extended it to the morning. So initially it was Philip Schofield would have been doing around Play School, which would have been the preschool programme that was always on at 10 o'clock in the morning on BBC One every day forever. And so they then did birthday cards around that, and then they said, right, well, when it's the Easter holidays and the summer holidays, we'll do like a 3-hour programme. And so But First This was the name of the first big kind of output that they did. And Andy Crane did that. And while he did that, I then went and did The Broom Cupboard for 3 months while he was doing that. And then we did a similar thing on a Sunday morning, which we called Now on 2. And then it became called CBBC 2. And so there were all of these. Children's BBC became a massive operation from one Philip Schofield doing the afternoons. It suddenly became, right, we need a someone here and a someone there. And that's when, you know, Andy Crane came in and I came in and Andy Peters came in and Philippa Forrester came in. And so it was a, you know, I was there at a brilliant time when there was enough TV viewers to make it, you know, a kind of seem like a big TV show. And we had access to all of the pop stars because they wanted to be singing their songs on the telly. So we had your Kylies and your Jasons and all of the, you know, the Stock Aitken and Waterman of that era would come on our show. And BFT on the mornings, we were allowed to broadcast from the roof of Television Centre. So we could get these, you know, big pop groups. We could fit them in a way that we couldn't in the little titchy studio that we were broadcasting from. And so it was just a, you know, a fantastic time to be part of the BBC, full stop, but also the evolution of Children's BBC. Now, of course, a whole TV channel.
Yes, and you've actually joined in on a lot of the anniversary celebrations when they've done those, haven't you?
Well, thankfully, they've asked me back, which is lovely. The last yes. one was 30 years. Whether or not there'll be a 40-year, who's to say? But it is so lovely. And again, what was lovely when we did the 30th anniversary one was that whole show was produced by someone who loved it growing up. So he knew, it's a fellow called Jamie Wilson, who's very important at BBC Children's now. He knew how important it had been to him and how it had, you know, steered him in the direction of being someone who worked in TV. And he's gone on to greatness himself. And so, you know, he put together a really genuinely lovely tribute to what that little Philip Schofield sitting in a cupboard did to TV.
What is like the one overriding memory that you have of that period that you spent doing that?
In terms of a specific event, it would be I was doing Children's BBC and I then had the opportunity to present Top of the Pops, which was lovely. And so the Children's BBC team said, well, why don't we do a behind-the-scenes video of Top of the Pops so you can go and do your Top of the Pops work, but we'll film it and then we'll have something to play out on Children's BBC. And it was a great idea. So we were recording this little video in the Top of the Pop studio, and I'm with Mark Goodyear, the Radio 1 DJ, and we're talking about the charts or something, and then Carmella, who was the floor manager, came over and said, oh, we need to do this, that and the other. And then a fellow came up to me and he said, excuse me, you're Simon, aren't you? And I turned around and said, yes. And I'm looking at Paul McCartney. And he said, I'm Paul McCartney, nice to meet you. And I said, what, really? And he said, no, but I thought he would be funny. And then we had a lovely chat, and I was gobsmacked. You know, when you kind of think, oh, my God, this is Paul McCartney. He knows who I am. He's talking to me. And I must have been a gibbering idiot. And all of this was filmed for this behind-the-scenes thing, so that was lovely. And then Paul McCartney was there because he was doing a bit of Top of the Pops. He was also doing an interview on The Ozone, which was part of Children's BBC's output. And so that was going to be done in the Blue Peter Garden. So I then took Paul McCartney to the Blue Peter Garden. Oh, come on, Paul, let me show you the way. And chatted to Paul McCartney as we went to the Blue Peter Garden. He then did the interview with Andy Crane. And then I'll show you the way back. So then there's me and Paul McCartney, and Linda was there. And we'd then walking back to Television Centre. Oh, right, here we go. That's Top of the Pop Studio. And then my dad came to see the show. He came to watch Top of the Pops being broadcast. And Paul McCartney came over at the end after having done, he did his song right at the end of the show. And he came over and he said to my dad, oh, you must be so proud of your son. And, you know, I'm thinking, this is the most surreal day I have ever had. That, you know, all because of my job on Children's BBC, one of the most famous men in the world, one of the Beatles, is chatting to me. I'm spending all of this quality time with him and he's talking to my dad. And so that's the one day that sticks out. I mean, every day at working at Television Centre was a lovely day. I would drive to work, and if I was allowed to park, we had a car park at the front, which was where only distinguished people were allowed to go, and a car park at the back. And we had to park in the car park at the back. But very occasionally, because I used to say to the nice security men, oh, can I park in the front? They'd go, yeah. And you'd park next to Noel Edmonds, or you would park next to Terry Wogan's Bentley. And you would go into Television Centre and you would literally walk down the corridors and you could go into all of the studios and nobody ever stopped you. There was no security or anything like that. Obviously, there was security to get in the building in the first place. But myself and Andy Peters, we'd just go around. We went to the pilot recording of Ab Fab. We went to the pilot recording of Bottom with Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson. Just because we were allowed to walk in. And of course, we knew all of the cameramen and stuff and the team down on the floor and Top of the Pops, you know, you would literally, you could just go and wander through and be, oh, there's Duran Duran. There's their dress. Oh, you bump into Kylie Minogue near the tea bar. So just being at Children's BBC and to spend the time that I spent with Andy Peters, who is probably the nicest man in the history of the world ever. He taught me so much about TV. When we were there, he just knows how to make TV work. And because I got on well with him, he just was so brilliant at saying, oh, no, do this, wear that, look at this, do that. You know, if you do the, and in that experience of being in that building, mixing with so many famous people, and, you know, not that they had any idea who I was, but just being within, you know, striking distance of Bruce Forsyth. It does make you up your game. It does make you want to be, you know, all of your potential. And to be, thankfully, mentored, albeit accidentally, by Andy Peters when we were just mucking about was just the most glorious time of my life.
It sounds wonderful. It's a great memory to have, I'm sure. And Television Centre, as it was, is greatly missed. Now, you obviously went on then to do morning television after CBBC. What was that like, kind of changing your audience? Because a children's audience is quite different to an adult one, isn't it?
Well, initially I went to GMTV, which was the new breakfast company that were taking over the TVAM franchise. And so I was doing the children's bit of an adult output, if that makes sense. So GMTV would broadcast from 6 in the morning until 9:25. And initially, I was there to do like a little 10-minute sort of newsy, children'sy slot. Not quite John Craven's News Round, but something right. That was reflecting the real world. And so that would be every morning at, I think it was something like 7:30 or something. And then I was also doing the summer holidays. So all of the things I'd done with BFT at the BBC, I was then doing at GMTV. So they had Lorraine Kelly would do a programme. It was called Top of the Morning. And she would do between, I think it was something like 8:25 and 9:25. And she wasn't on during the Easter holidays and the summer holidays. And that's when my show would be on. And so I was doing the children's bit of that. So it was, I was still doing children's programmes, but I was working for ITV, which was completely new to me. And I was working for a brand new company, because GMTV was an actual company that was formed to do this breakfast TV output. And primarily, it was a news programme. So I was working in a newsroom with all of these very well respected journalists like Fiona Armstrong and Eamon Holmes and Michael Wilson. And so, you know, it was just an amazing time. And GMTV, pre-going on air, we did like 3 months of every day we pretended we were on air. We did pilot programmes. And there would be champagne receptions afterwards, and we'd go and the sales team would take us to meet the clients. And it was an amazing experience. Then we got on air and then it all started to unravel a little bit because the ratings weren't as good as everyone had thought they were going to be, because the Channel 4 show, The Big Breakfast, had launched within the time that we were doing our pilots, and they'd kind of come on air as this very brash, bright TV breakfast show. And by the time we got on air, they'd sort of settled down a bit and people were beginning to like it. So GMTV had a bit of a, I wouldn't say a troubled start, but it didn't go as smoothly once we got on air as we had previously. But, you know, it was a lovely experience, and it was all done from the LWT building. So, you know, again, an iconic building where they'd done Game for a Laugh and they'd done all of these massive shows, Beatles About and Cilla Black, Surprise, Surprise, and Blind Date was all done there. And, you know, that's on the South Bank, where the Ant and Dec show, where, you know, up to last year, when they used to do the, right, we're going to abseil down the side of this tall building. It was that building. Beautiful bit of London as well, just by the river. And so, you know, again, I was on a crest of a wave. They paid loads of money as well. So, you know, I went from the BBC to ITV, and that was all good. And it was a brilliant experience. And then I was able to grow up a little bit. Whilst I was doing children's programmes, by the time GMTV, my time at GMTV ended, I was doing like a sort of a weekly news review programme. So I was that little bit more mature in the way that I was doing the broadcasting. And then that then helped me go off and do various bits of adult television that I then went and did. But GMTV was great, because that's where I met my wife. So, you know, the lovely experience that I had at Children's BBC, because it was just such a fun time. When I then went to GMTV, it was equally as good. And then that shaped the rest of my life, because my wife and I are still together. And, you know, every time I go down to London and go past the South Bank, I look at that lovely building and think, oh, it's where I met my wife. So, you know, all lovely.
And eventually, you ended up at Meridian doing the weather. How did you end up doing the weather?
I had been, after I did GMTV, I then did various bits of television for ITV. At that point, still had lots of different regions. So I did a bit of work for Granada up in Manchester. I did a show that went out on HTV, which is my home region here in Somerset, where I live now. And I was doing all these bits and bobs of telly. And at HTV, they took their weather for their regional news from a service provided in Birmingham. And they decided that they wanted to have their own weather person. And so, because I was doing stuff at HTV, I said to the people at HTV, you know, you're looking for this weather person. Is it worth me applying? And the guy at HTV said, oh, yes, of course it is. So I then applied. And the job would be that you would do the weather on the regional news programme, but you'd also be involved in different bits of the output. And so I applied and I auditioned and I learned about doing the weather, even though I had no weather experience. But, you know, my presenting experience meant that I could sort of have a go at telling the weather story in a way that made some sort of sense. And then I didn't get the job. And so that I thought, OK, that's fine. And then the person who was the boss at HTV West, which was my region, then passed my tape on to the guy who was in charge of ITV West Country, which back then only covered sort of Devon and Cornwall. And so I just got this random phone call about 6 months later saying, oh, we saw your tape. Would you be interested in coming and doing something here? So I went to see them, and their weather presenter was taking 6 months off for maternity leave, and they said, do you want to do her job for 6 months? So I thought, well, it's you know, ITV West Country. If I'm rubbish at it, no one's going to see it. You know, what's the worst that can happen? So I said, yeah. And it was, funny enough, it was a really lovely, it was the summer of 2006. The weather was great. And I was basically just travelling down to different bits of Devon and Cornwall, spending every day at the seaside, doing all the weather outside and doing all of this lovely stuff that was amazing. And that came to an end. And that's when ITV Meridian were launching the Thames Valley service. And so they said, well, do you want to come and do that here? And so that's what I did. And that then meant 11 years staying at ITV Meridian, which eventually meant that there was various incarnations. ITV did lots of sort of, the network shrank, the region shrank. So the ITV West Country that I worked in the first place was then absorbed into ITV West, and that's now one big ITV West Country region. When I joined Meridian, there was a Meridian East that served Kent and East Sussex, and there was a Meridian West that covered Dorset and Hampshire, and then there was a Thames Valley that covered Oxfordshire and a bit of Wiltshire. And so then all of that was absorbed into one big programme, and I was lucky enough to be kept on. And that's when I then was doing Meridian Tonight with the lovely Fred Dynage and Sangeeta Barbara.
Which must have been quite a surreal experience, because very much like you said about the CBBC producer had grown up watching you, you'd grown up watching Fred, I would assume.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what a thing to find myself in the company of Fred Dynage. You know, and we shared a dressing room. And so Fred and I were, you know, we were just so physically close. But also we would, of course, we'd have chats about, oh, God, you know, I'm really cheesed off about this today, and, you know, real life stuff. And he was there for some, you know, some really serious moments in my life that he was the person that I spoke to while we were powdering our noses with Max Factor makeup, you know, and that kind of the oddness. But, you know, a lovelier man you could not wish to meet. And gosh, when I was there, he celebrated 50 years with ITV. What an incredible achievement. And, you know, he's still there now. His hair has never changed, which I think we need to look into a little bit further. But, you know, like I say, a lovelier man you could not wish to meet. And I feel so privileged and lucky. And again, my whole life has been this series of lucky breaks. But, you know, to look back and think, wow, I did that and that and that. And then, you know, I used to share a dressing room with Fred Dynage, you know. I could go now and be happy.
He used to call you Simon Perky Parkin, if I remember rightly.
He did, yes. Much to the disapproval of many viewers who didn't like the nickname. I could take it either way, personally. That's, yes. No, lovely man.
Yes. So what are you up to these days? You left Meridian some time ago. What are you up to now?
Well, all through the time that I was working at Meridian, I was living in Somerset. So when my wife and I had our first child, we moved out of London, and then we then moved even further out of London and ended up in Somerset. So I think we've been here now for, I don't know, 23, 24 years or something now, a very long time. So I always did lots of massive commutes. So when I joined ITV West Country, I was driving from Somerset down to Plymouth, which is where we did that every day. And then when ITV Meridian, the job came up there, ITV was in a very, very, it wasn't in a great place. Financially, it wasn't doing very well. The regional output was being, you know, shrunk back. And so I thought, well, I'm not in a situation where we can move the family. My children were, my eldest was going to be starting senior school soon. And so I said, well, you know, this, it's ITV. I mean, it's going to last like another year, if that, so we'll just stay in Somerset. So I stayed in Somerset and then would drive to Southampton every day, which was 2 hours there, 2 hours back. And then when I was at Meridian, also some days they'd say, right, we need you to do an OB in Dover. And so I would drive from my house in Somerset to Meridian in Southampton, then drive to Dover, and then have to get all the way back home about like 10:30 at night to then get up tomorrow morning to start the whole thing all over again. And so I was just beginning to feel that I was perhaps doing a bit too much schlepping around, and I was getting a bit tired. And I was also, having done the weather for such a long time, I was sort of keen to do other stuff. And at Meridian, just before I left, they gave me the opportunity to sit in for Fred and present the actual news show, which was an amazing experience. But all the while that I've been doing that, I've been working at BBC Radio Somerset, which is a local radio station in the county. I've been here for 15 years doing Saturday breakfast. And in all of the time that I've been here, they kept on coming to me every sort of couple of years going, do you think you'd like to come full time? And I was like, no. I'm working for ITV. You know, they pay too much. Well, you can't afford me and all of that kind of stuff. And then eventually BBC Radio Somerset came to me one time and I thought, actually, you know, this is actually worth thinking about, seriously. And so I talked to the boss of Radio Somerset and said, well, you know, if I were to come full time, what would that mean? And it coincided with my son going off to university. He's my youngest. So my wife would have basically been just sitting at home all day, every day, waiting for me to get home at like 9 o'clock from my long day in Southampton. And so the timing just sort of worked. And so I then left Meridian. You know, it was really sad to leave because I loved working there. And I, you know, it was for no other reason than I just needed to not be working quite as hard as I was. And so I then have been at BBC Radio Somerset ever since, where I now do the morning show, which is 10 until 2 every day. And I get to talk to the most interesting of people. So this morning, for example, I spoke to a man who he was struck down by the pandemic, by COVID-19, and he was in hospital and he was in a coma, an induced coma for 9 days. And he was told before he was put in the coma that he might not come out of it. And to share his experience and share his story, you know, what an amazing position of privilege that I'm in, that I get to talk to people like him. He also, you know, I spoke to Len Goodman off Strictly this week and had a lovely chat with him. And so I have this lovely job where I get to talk to the most interesting people who have the most interesting stories to tell. And thankfully, the people of Somerset sort of come along and they chip in with their stories as well. And so that's what I'm doing now.
And in a roundabout way, you've almost come full circle, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, starting off in radio and then to be back in radio is lovely. Radio is I mean, I love doing TV, don't get me wrong. But I love doing radio as well. And to be able to do both would be the dream if there is a way. For all of those years that I was doing Meridian, I was doing BBC Somerset on the side, and it was almost like the perfect life that I had a sort of a mix of both of them. And I would love to do more TV in the future, but I wouldn't ever not want to do radio, because radio is such a, well, you know, we're here on a podcast, and this is a podcast that someone has decided, oh, that sounds interesting, I want to listen to that. And they want to, you know, they just want to listen to this conversation that we're having. And hopefully they're going to maybe hear something on it that they've never heard before. And they're hopefully going to, you know, maybe be reminded of something that happened to them all those years ago, and that kind of thing. And that's, radio has that lovely power to be able to do that. TV is all a bit in your face. You know, they say, we're talking about carrots, and they show you a picture of a carrot. So you don't even have to imagine what a carrot looks like. Whereas with the radio, everything is imagination. And so, you know, it's such a lovely medium to be able to play with. So, you know, I'm absolutely blessed, like I say, firstly, that I'm still getting away with being allowed to broadcast. Secondly, by an organisation like the BBC, they still trust me. And, you know, thirdly, that I've had the career that I've had, and, you know, long may it continue.
Yes, indeed. And as you say, the magic of radio. And I'd like to say thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today. It's been great to talk to you and find out lots of questions that have been in my mind for a long time. Always wanted to talk to you, so thank you for allowing me to do that. And all the best for the future.
Oh, thank you, and absolute pleasure. And thank you ever so much for asking. It was really lovely for you to say, do you want to come on and talk about this? And I've had a lovely chat. Thank you.
TV and radio presenter Simon Parkin talking to me, Jamie Dyer, about his days in the broom cupboard and everything that he has done since on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast. This is a CBBC or Children's BBC special. And now I present to you an interview that I recently did with Guy Lambert, former TV producer who worked at CBBC between 2003 and 2010. And I was delighted to get this interview. The first question that I asked him was, how did he get the job at the BBC? And this was his reply.
I basically had always wanted to work at the BBC, and it'd always been my dream to go there and be a producer. I had never really thought about doing children's stuff. I love children's TV, and I grew up with Blue Peter and or Biker Grove and Grange Hill and all those sort of things. My passion for children's TV was unleashed when a friend of mine asked me to join him on a Disney show, which I did for a couple of months, which was continuity for the Disney Channel in the mornings. And we had a puppet dinosaur doing it, and he was linking into shows and doing all the continuity business, you know, coming up next is this, and at 10 o'clock is this, and all this sort of thing. Then suddenly I saw this job advertised on the BBC website for a CBBC continuity person. I just thought, why not? You know, just give it a go. And I applied, in those days, it was a massively long form, did the form, talked all about this Disney project, got an interview, and then got the job. I mean, it was literally like, it sounds like it was out of the blue, but I had been working in TV for about a good 6 years. So it wasn't completely like out of the blue. I didn't like walk into it, but it was as simple as that, which is, you know, that's the story.
From what I remember, CBBC continuity was pretty much off screen at that point, wasn't it?
No, at that point it had been on because this was 2003. So it had been on screen for quite a while, actually, at that point. I think a lot of the CBBC channel stuff very probably was off screen, because certainly when I joined, there was a lot of voiceover stuff going on, and particularly like, you know, in the mornings on the channel, there was a lot of that. No, at that point, it was an enormous operation. They had three studios at that point. I mean, considering where it had come from, like, I know you've been talking to Simon Parkin, and when he was doing it, it was literally a tiny room. It had exploded into a studio for the CBBC channel and another studio for BBC One. In the years I was there, there was a third studio that came along to do lots of stuff for BBC Two. So it very much became very on screen and live, a lot of it as well.
Yeah, that must have been some pressure being live. I mean, give us a little bit of a snapshot as to what your role is during all this.
It depended, the extent of it and the amount of it depended on what you were doing. So if you were doing the CBBC channel, for example, a lot of the links were very short, or they were just like voiceovers or whatever. Or you'd have an ongoing kind of, not theme, but like maybe there was a send-in during the afternoon. From 2003 to 2010, I was there. From 2003 to 2006, it was very much on BBC Two, BBC One, and the CBBC channel. BBC One was thought about as a big BBC One event. So that's why on BBC One, we had Andrew Hayden-Smith and Angelica Bell. We had much more what were considered BBC One type presenters. And Angelica and Andrew would never do CBBC channel. It was very distinct. And as a consequence, it had a very different feel. So on BBC One, you were much more about creating that event, creating a sense of this is, you are home from school and this is the best like entertainment show that you'll watch. So we would have a lot more guests, people from Neighbours, pop stars, people. It was very much a one show type philosophy, I suppose, in that respect. So your job as a producer was to oversee those links between the shows, and how long you had for those links depended on all sorts of different things. But you basically had a choice of what you wanted to do every day on there. And I did run the BBC One slot for quite a while, and it was an exciting opportunity to go, okay, let's put some regular features in there, like regular competitions. What clips do we need to show? Because we need to serve the bigger channel. We need to show clips of programs like Top of the Pop Saturday or things like that, Dick and Dom, that are coming up. So a lot of it was very much a mixture of imagination and creativity, freedom to do what you wanted, but all within the framework of promoting CBBC and promoting the shows. It's a very hard job to explain because at the time I was there between 2003 and 2010, it changed so much. You know, it went from being Andrew Hayne-Smith, Angelica Bell, Simon Grant, Jake Humphrey, into Ed and Oucho, into Ian and Hacker. It evolved and its function changed quite drastically sort of midway through. And it became much more about comedy and entertainment than it did presenter-led, one-show-type situations, if that makes sense. It was a very clear division between 2003 to 2006 and 2007 to 2010.
Yeah, because certainly in more recent times, in that latter bracket, you had more puppets, didn't you?
Well, yes. It was funny because when I joined in 2003, I was like, oh, where's the puppet? You know, I knew what was going on that on the channel, but I was very keen to get a puppet. And I remember, much to the annoyance of my boss, having a deliberately rubbish puppet who was this dog, and or was it a rabbit? I can never remember because it was this brown thing with ears, and I think it could have been a dog or a rabbit. And it was like deliberately rubbish. And Matt Edmondson and Anne Foy would take the mick out of it on air. And he would always say to me, oh, get rid of it, get rid of it. I'd be like, no, it's great, it's very funny. I remember my eyes lighting up the day that they told me that they were going to, we have a new boss at CBBC and she wants there to be a puppet. And I was so delighted. And I was put in charge of, with other people, but I was heading up the design the new puppet thing. And in the end, that is what became Oucho the Cactus, which... who began the new generation of puppets, because we had Oucho the Cactus, then we had Dunstan the Brain for a while, and then of course along came Hacker, who has been there for what feels like about 500 years. bless Hacker.
I know he's still very much a popular character now, even in his own shows, which is amazing.
Phil Fletcher, who, as you know, as we say, is Hacker's assistant. He is a bizarre and brilliant genius of a man. I was introduced to him about 2 years before he did Hacker, and he came in. I remember phoning him. He won't mind me telling you the story, but I phoned him from you know, metropolitan London, and I called him up in Wigan, and I said, "Oh, Warwick, who is Oucho's assistant, would love you to come and be a cactus," or cacti, I suppose is the right thing. And he was like, well, I can't do the accent, so I won't even try. But he was like, well, it depends. Do you need me to come down to London? And I have got lots of ferrets or pigeons. I can't remember if it was ferrets or pigeons. And it almost sounded like reluctant to do it. And I kind of convinced him to come down. And then he was remembered when it came to do a new series of another show, and that's how he got his part as Hacker. But what a lot of people don't know about Hacker is when he came and he joined with Ian, the remit was that the dog should not talk, and so Hacker's role was to literally sort of mumble things like that and look at cameras and occasionally bark. And I used to get into terrible trouble because I'd write him dialogue and it would be crossed out in meetings and just have like woof written instead. And I pushed it so that he would talk more, which didn't make me very popular. But then as soon as they realized that Phil is brilliant, Hacker just became Phil, really. This mad comedy genius who is the most entertaining man you'll ever meet.
Yeah, it always looks very, you know, he's always a very entertaining character. And I almost term him as like the modern day Roland Rat.
Yeah.
That's sort of the vibe that I get whenever I see him on whatever program he does now. Was there anything that you wrote down or anything that was kind of planned and then kiboshed at the last minute?
Almost nothing ever, which actually wasn't necessarily good lesson for a young producer, I had bosses that were incredibly tolerant, incredibly allowing of creativity. I was so fortunate that for the vast majority of my time there, my bosses, I wouldn't say let me do what I wanted, because they would always keep an eye and be like, well, maybe that line is going a little bit too far. And I would go, yeah, you're right. I've kind of, you know, you have to operate within a certain framework. I do remember once not being allowed to do a Prince Charles thing, but I remember that really stood out as the only time my boss ever said to me, I am not going to allow you to do that. And I was like, why? And there was some sort of sensitivity at the time about something that had happened with the Queen and the BBC, and I can't remember the details, but it was around about 2008, and something had happened, and he said, look, this is just an area, you know, this is going to cause issues. So I remember being very reluctant to drop it, and one of my presenters was like, no, do it. And I was like, no, we can't, we don't want to destroy the BBC. That is honestly the only thing I can think of.
My other question was there anything you tried and then afterwards went, no, that was terrible?
Oh, yes, all the time. But that's what made it so good, because when I did Ed and Out Show, for example, every afternoon on CBBC, we were live from about 3:25 to 6:30, and then we had our pre-recorded final link at 7. So often you were doing probably about 20 to 25 minutes, maybe sometimes 30 minutes a day of live telly. And we saw it in those days with Ed Nautra, it was very much like there was a storyline across the week, and each day would contribute. It was like having an episode of that storyline. And so kids would follow the links and understand the narratives. And sometimes we would do things and we just, for some reason, the magic wasn't there. But very rarely, and weirdly, they were so rare that I remember the two occasions where it really wasn't very good. I remember Stephen Moffat saying about a Doctor Who story that he didn't think was very good that he'd done. You can think your work is not very good because you didn't feel it on the day, or it wasn't fun to do, or there were issues, or something happened. But to the audience, they probably went, that's fine. Like, you know what I mean? It's very hard to make a judgment. But we did have days where I would say that things didn't work because the team, we weren't in the right mood. It didn't work for us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think there are times when the time between planning it and it actually taking place, the moment almost passes somewhat. You feel like maybe it doesn't really fly too much anymore.
Yeah, because with Ed Naucho, we would plan it. We would always work 2 days ahead. So Monday morning, we'd go in and be planning what we were doing on Wednesday. So we worked that so we could get the props ready, and we, you know, costumes and book guests or whatever. We had gave ourselves time. And sometimes the energy you have in a brainstorm where you go, oh, we should do this. It'd be really funny if this happened, and he could do this and he could do that. And then you'd cast it and you get the props and stuff. And just sometimes it wasn't quite as good as you imagined. And sometimes you'd run with that and make a thing of that or change something. And sometimes you were just like, oh, this isn't going to be great. And it's very hard when everyone in a room knows it's not going to be good, because it's very hard to go, come on, everyone. It's so hard. But that is part of your job, talking about the job of a producer. Part of your job is to motivate and to energize and to carry the mood of the team. And I only realized that, I suppose, retrospectively, and I wish I'd known it at the time, because I think it's very important, particularly when you're on talkback, you're talking to everyone and you set the mood and you set the tone. And my number one tone would always be, we're all going to try our damnedest to make this as good as we can. And I would be relentless. And sometimes I feel quite borderline, not bullying, that's not the right word, but borderline, I don't know what the word is, probably a bit out of order. Not horribly, but you know what I mean? Just a bit too much and a bit too keen. But always with the idea that what we have to do is deliver the best thing for the kids. Because I always said to presenters that for me, when you're a kid and you run home from school and you put the telly on and it's your savior, you could have had the worst day at school ever. You could live in the worst place ever. But we were the escape and it was our job to be brilliant. And I would not accept half-assed, half-hearted stuff. I just would be in, I would drive people mad. I'm sure people hated me because of it. But I was driven by that rule that everything we did had to be as good as we could make it.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because I felt that I was always, I mean, I could admit now, I was always the one that watched The Other Side. I was the person that, I watched The Other Side. But the thing is, when you joined, the market on The Other Side sort of fell out and funding started to be reduced.
Yes, which we were very aware of, because around about 2006, 2007, suddenly everything on Disney, Nickelodeon and CITV either vanished completely or started to. We were very aware of, I don't think it was necessarily a good thing for CBBC, just sort of in the mentality of it. I don't think it's good not to have a rival, because I think you become your own rival, or you have no one to critique or battle. You know what I mean? I think it's not good. And I don't think anything specific came of that, but I think it could, I would say that it just didn't help drive ambition, and in certain people I felt it installed a bit of an arrogance, because there was nothing to go, oh, they're doing that, we should do this. We had nothing to bounce off. Do you know what I mean?
I get it. When you don't have competition, you've got nothing to kind of either be inspired from or to fight against.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think being inspired by is a very good point, because we would look at what they were doing and go, right, why is that? Of course, you're looking for it to be rubbish. You're looking to go, why is that rubbish? Why doesn't that work? Well, how could we do that better? Or they're doing that, therefore we won't do that. And I'm not saying I was massively, massively conscious of The Other Side, because to be honest, I don't feel like we really talked about it that much. But it gave us a sense of what we were about. Like, we were about this, not that. We were about this kind of thing, not that kind of thing. And I think when the others disappeared, there was a little bit of a question mark about what, and it also elevated CBBC to a level where it became representative of all children's television, which is a hell of a responsibility, and I think puts it under the microscope in a way that's unfair, because you can't say, oh, well, all right, you know, we made this show and maybe it's not great, but look at what they're doing with the same money. There was nothing to compare it to, and I think that can be a bit unfair, really.
When you look back at your time working at the BBC, what's like the one thing that stands out to you?
I would say opportunity. The working, and I feel like this has gone a bit since it moved away from Television Centre, but I could be wrong because I don't work there, so I don't know. But the greatest thing about working for the BBC at that time in Television Centre was that sense of magic and opportunity, that you could walk past Jonathan Ross in a corridor. You could go to the BBC canteen and see other shows, other people doing things. You had a sense that there was a bigger picture, and it would make you want to be ambitious, because it would inspire you to go, oh, I want to be with them. Like, I always wanted to do Blue Peter. And when I joined, they were like, yeah, you know, logically your path would be to go and do Blue Peter and other things, and you'd be part of the BBC, you know, for life kind of thing. That was the philosophy back then in 2003, which could completely change by 2010. Because then the BBC was this magical, it was just magical. It was just like, you just felt like you were in the best place and you had the ability and the opportunity and the resources to make the best thing you could. And yeah, that's my memory of it, really. I don't know what the word is that sums it up. Opportunity, I suppose.
It's funny you should say all of that, because that's exactly what, almost word for word, exactly what Simon Parkin said.
Really?
Yes.
How bizarre.
Almost exactly. He said something very much on the same level, the walking past all these famous people and the aspirational thing. Yeah, he said pretty much the same thing. So I think that says more about the Television Centre and the attitude of the BBC at that particular moment in time than anything else. That's fascinating. What are you up to these days?
Well, as we speak, we're obviously in the midst of coming, you know, whatever point we are at with this coronavirus lark. So after I left the BBC, I did a variety of different things, a lot of children's stuff. I did a really good children's short film, lots of casting. And then the children's industry really kind of just started dying away again, which was a shame. Then I became a talent agent. Did that for nearly 3 years. And that was really exciting. And to be honest, I got to the point at the end of 2018 where I was like, I've been in this business for 20 years. I'm really quite tired. Like, where's the resources of my body with the energy and enthusiasm and inspiration? I was like, what do I want to do next? So I took a break, and I teach English to Chinese students from home, which I've been doing since 2018, very happily. I bought my house and I sort of slightly semi-retired psychologically. But then I said to myself at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, I was like, right, I'm going to go back. It's time to come back. And I've had various people try to get me back, into it. What I really want to do now is write. So mark this down, because in the next 5 years, I want to have become a writer properly full time, and I'm aiming to get at least a drama series on the ground, off the ground somewhere, and a cartoon show, hopefully. I've got lots of aspirations to write. I think that's where I want to be at the moment. And who knows what doors that will open.
Former TV producer Guy Lambert, talking to me, Jamie Dyer, on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast about his days at CBBC and everything that he's done since then. And it was great to talk to both Guy and Simon today in this CBBC special. And I should say that every week isn't like this. If you're just tuning in, we have specials occasionally based around one thing, and then others it'll be a range of different subjects. Now, next week is a 90s and Noughties roundtable, based around the band Five. We're going to be looking at the album Invincible with a group of Five fans. So I very much look forward to sharing that with you. I've been recording those over the past month or so, and I'm not sure what is going to be the second segment in that episode. So you're going to have to stay tuned to find out what that is. But if you've got any suggestions for future subjects or topics that we can cover on this podcast, anything 90s and noughties, UK specifically. So perhaps you remember watching News Round on an afternoon, or maybe you used to watch CD UK, or perhaps you bought the latest Adam Rickett single back in 1999. Perhaps you remember SMTV Live, or maybe you went to a gig in the 90s. Maybe you saw Bewitched Live or Steps or S Club or any of those. Whatever it may be, I'd love to hear from you. But first, I'd like to say thank you very much for listening to this edition of the 90s and Noughties UK podcast, a podcast on UK pop culture from the 90s and 2000s. Yes, indeed. This has been Jamie Dyer. And if you'd like to get in contact with the podcast, you can. You can email 90snoughties@gmail.com. You can also go onto Twitter and tweet us at 90snoughties UK. Or you can go to the Facebook page, which is just simply 90s and Noughties UK. Thank you once again for listening, and bye-bye for now.